My guest on this episode is Olive Gray. Olive Gray is a dyspraxic actor, musician and poet. Olive's acting career began in The Story of Tracy Beaker, followed by a string of guest appearances in EastEnders. In recent years, you may have also seen Olive in smash hit shows such as Save Me on Sky Atlantic, Fleabag on the BBC, and comedy drama Sex Education over on Netflix. Olive is a graduate of the Guildhall School of Music and Drama and the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art for Shakespeare.
Hi, Olive. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
No trouble. I've been looking into your background, and I was doing my research for potential guests, and I saw that you was from you predominantly make a stance for ADHD, and it was also brought to my attention that you had dyspraxia as well, and it's just staggering, in my opinion, how like people like yourselves haven't been brought forward in the dyspraxia community before, because it just seems like you're on quite a big platform, like your shows are like such as like Sex Education, and it's quite a big platform, that reach there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely something that I didn't anticipate in my life, being that I would speak more about ADHD than I do dyspraxia, because I feel like both of those things affect my life so greatly. I think it's interesting for me, because I was diagnosed with dyspraxia when I was maybe 12.
Okay.
And I wasn't diagnosed with ADHD till I was 18. So for like pretty much the entire time I was in secondary school, as far as I knew, all I kind of was struggling with at the time in terms of school was dyspraxia.
Yeah.
And I do think that sometimes what ended up happening was some of my kind of the things I do that would maybe I would attribute more to my ADHD, I kind of would lump into my dyspraxia because I didn't understand why I kind of did them. And so I was like, well, I guess that's just a part of being dyspraxic. But I think that I'm understanding more and more through both of those diagnoses, kind of what each one individually means and how they individually affect my life.
What led you to getting the ADHD diagnosis? So like late on, if you think about it, and most people usually get it when they're a lot younger, don't they?
Yeah. A lot of people get diagnosed really young. It was really interesting to me, because all I really knew of ADHD was hyperactivity, and my inward hyperactivity inside my head, it's insane. It's like a Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. But outside, I don't really feel like I present in a hyperactive way. And so like my understanding of ADHD was not really fully correct, because I was like, well, I can't possibly have that, because, you know, I'm not that hyper kid. I wasn't the kid that was running around the classroom. And so therefore, I can't have it. And as well that I was diagnosed as an adult, it was just, very interesting. But I feel like both dyspraxia and ADHD are things that just are incredibly misunderstood. And I think particularly, you know, in places like America, in terms of ADHD, like I think the understanding is just not there. And I think that people associate ADHD with the naughty kid who, you know, has a bad home life, and so therefore like people invalidate the diagnosis, or, you know, they think that it's kids who need to have Ritalin, which isn't even always the best thing for all kids with ADHD. And yeah, I think there's a lot of kind of misunderstanding and misinformation. And I think it can be really hard then for people who do get diagnosed with these things, and to try and find a sense of freedom in that, when kind of the rest of the world is telling you, oh, you know, you don't have that, or don't say that you have that, because, you know, you don't want to label yourself. But actually, labels can be really helpful, and they can be really helpful in understanding and also explaining to other people, this is going to be a bit more difficult to me, or bear with me, because, you know, this is how I learn, or this is how I do things, and it's not going to be the same as somebody else who's neurotypical.
Certainly, yeah. And did you find that
you got more help and support with the like labels of having dyspraxia and ADHD, or you
just well, I don't really think so. No, I think I got definitely had support in terms of when I was diagnosed with ADHD. I had like a specific doctor that, you know, helped me through stuff, and I tried different medications. But in terms of the world, no, I was diagnosed with dyspraxia in school. And I told my teachers and nothing changed whatsoever. I went to a sports school as well, so I was, you know, it was difficult, like doing like sports, and there were girls who ended up going to Wimbledon and, you know, who are professional hockey players and, you know, training for the Olympics, and I was not that at all. And it was difficult. It was hard because I think that, like, even though they had pushed for that diagnosis, they didn't make any effort to understand it. You know, we even had a person once a week who would sit with us and talk through, you know, our disability and to help us one-on-one. And all she did with me anyway was spelling tests. I don't know if she thought that dyslexia was the same as dyspraxia, or if she just thought that, you know, oh, you have a learning thing, and so, okay, therefore let's just learn how to spell things. But I'm quite good at spelling. It's more the, you know, things that you know, fine motor skills and stuff like that I'm going to be struggling with. So yeah, it was really, really not helpful in terms of other people understanding me, but it was incredibly helpful for understanding myself and, you know, eventually advocating for myself, which I think is my passion. My passion isn't really in, you know, going and teaching people about ADHD and dyspraxia. My passion is teaching people with ADHD and dyspraxia so that they can advocate for themselves. I think that that's the best way. Because I have so many friends who've been diagnosed with both of those things separately and together, and don't really have much of an understanding of what that means for their lives past the fact that they have the diagnosis. And I think that, like, it's important to, for example, with me with ADHD, it affects my processing. So the way I have a conversation with somebody, if it gets like a heated argument, my processing of language can be really difficult because it's too fast. So I'm able to say, can we just slow this down, because I'm not able to process it at the speed that you're speaking to me. And I just don't want to say the wrong thing. But if I didn't know that, and if I didn't understand that, then I wouldn't be able to advocate for myself, and I would almost be relying on other people to be learning about this stuff in their, you know, rather than being able to teach other people.
Nice. Yeah. So at school, would you say you had poor concentration, and did you suffer greatly because of that?
Yes. Oh my gosh, yeah. I think, do you know what? I think I was a child who really wanted to get it right. When I was really young, if I did something wrong, I would be so apologetic to my parents. I'd feel so guilty. And I think I just always wanted to get it right. And so going to school, I think I had that same outlook. And the problem is that because I struggled to focus, the teachers then saw me as kind of choosing to be insolent or choosing to disregard the lesson. And so I was then really quickly labeled as a naughty child. And because I was labeled as a naughty child so young, it almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think a part of me couldn't bear the feeling of disappointing people. And so I thought, do you know, I would rather not try to be good, because then if I try to be good and I fail, it hurts so much more than going, I'm just going to be naughty. And then at least I'm getting what I want because I'm trying to, you know, be naughty and it's working. I think that then became my outlook. And it really feels like such a shame, because I almost feel like I was robbed of an opportunity to have the education that I should have had by the fact that people just didn't understand the way I learned and the way I process things and my disability. You know, I would lose focus, and then in order to focus again, I would be fidgeting, and then I would be fidgeting, so they'd tell me I was being naughty and trying to be disruptive, so I would try to sit still, and then I would lose focus. It was just like a never-ending repetitive cycle, and it felt like no matter, you know, what way or how many times I tried to explain why this was happening, or my mum or dad tried to explain to the teachers why this was happening, there was never more of an understanding.
That sounds so like sad in a way, because that just reminds me of my own sort of schooling, because although I was diagnosed with dyspraxia very young, there was no understanding of it. They just assumed it was dyslexia.
Yeah.
And they tried to teach me as if I had dyslexia, which in yes. later life, I have actually been diagnosed with dyslexia. But I never picked up on it at school, funny enough.
Yes.
And this year, I've been diagnosed with ADHD. And
oh, wow.
At school, I played up to the negativity, right? Mm-hmm. Played up the stereotype, well, you know, you think I'm unruly and unteachable, so I'll act that way, and
yes.
that way no one's disappointed, because you know
what's going to 100%. 100%.
And I feel so like my own education was poor because of it, and yeah. I just think if given the chance, I'd go back again, and knowing that I could get the right help, and who to go for help, I think.
I just think that, like, our education system is set up for only one type of brain. And it's not even like the majority of people have that type of brain. I think it's just like it's set up for one type of brain, and then everyone else is just trying to have that type of brain. And some people are good at trying more than others, and some people are really awful at even coming close to that mark. Yeah. But it just feels like it's such a disservice to children and young adults to feel like there's only one way to succeed in life. And success looks like one type of thing. It's such a shame.
Yeah, certainly. I find it so frustrating when I hear like these horror stories from people that just like never got any help.
Yes.
I've gone undiagnosed for everything, and they're just like gravitating through life slowly, but
yes. like
unaided, and it's quite sad.
Yeah, really.
So would you say you were supported by your teachers when they, like, even though they didn't quite fully understand dyspraxia and they didn't know you had ADHD, did they help you to the best of their ability at the time, or?
No, I would say I was absolutely berated by my teachers on a daily basis. I had the, like, in terms of, like, you know, some people go to school and they are horrifically bullied. I think I had that experience with my teachers. I think they were horrific. To the point that I think that they began to actively try to tear me down. And I think that's for a number of reasons. I went to a boarding school in the countryside, and I was one of very, 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 very few non-white students. I have ADHD. I think it was just a lot of... I wasn't privately educated before, so I come from the kind of state school in North London to this like Hogwarts place. The teachers were horrific, truly.
How did you find that adjustment then, going from like your normal sort of secondary school and then get like or normal schooling environment to boarding school environment? How did you find that?
It was very, very, very odd. In terms of the change, yeah. It was intense because the teachers were different. I don't know if that's the same for everyone going to secondary school though, so I don't know that. I know the big differences in terms of the culture shock were like just the things that the students cared about, or like the girls cared about designer clothes, and I don't think I even was conscious of like that there were designer clothes. Things like that were obviously very different, but I think for me, the biggest difficulty in terms of like two different worlds was the fact that I started working in TV quite young. And so I had been in an environment from around 10 years old where I was advocating for myself and communicating with adults in an adult way from 10. And like that's how my parents spoke to me. You know, we would have conversations about things, and I would go, okay, I don't understand. Can you explain to me why you don't want me to do this? And then if you don't want me to do it, that's cool, but let's have a conversation about it. Or I would be able to go, do you know what? I'm feeling this, can we talk about that? And school is just not like that. School, you know, some amazing schools probably are that have like 10 students in a room, but generally speaking, schools and the schooling system was set up around the time of the Industrial Revolution. And so we're kind of all entering into this big machine where individuality is not encouraged.
Yeah.
And so like I think I struggled because I wanted to have adult conversations with people who viewed a young person wanting an adult conversation to be incredibly insolent and incredibly rude and incredibly, just disrespectful. And so I didn't really I couldn't and still can't really wrap my head around why that was. I was just very, very misunderstood. I think like my intentions were really good and, you know, it was just not taken the right way. And I think I started not great because I came there and I think this was a big difference to go from a school that's in one building to a school that is the size of an American university campus. Absolutely massive, where to walk from one building to another could take up to 10 minutes or 15 minutes even. And there are boarding houses and there's a block for each class. And we have timetables, which I had never read in my entire life. I'd never read a timetable. And school started at 8 and finished at 7. And every class had a different book that we had to know what book we were bringing. And I think for the first like a month, I didn't arrive to a single class on time, not a single one. I think sometimes I was up to 40 minutes late. I would be walking around literally nearly in tears with my anxiety through the roof. Like I don't know how to find this class. I don't understand the timetable. I don't know how to read this. I don't know where, how are people remembering? And I would carry every single book for every single class on my back. So then I developed chronic back problems, which I've had ever since. And I think because I would then turn up to this class 20 minutes late and then take 5 minutes trying to figure out what book I needed, trying to rummage through my bag while the teacher was teaching, I think I just came across as, I was just labeled as rude when I wasn't trying to be, I was trying my hardest, but just catastrophically failing.
Bless. Did you find their approach to disabilities in the boarding school to be better than your state education, or was that pretty much the same?
It was different. I think in my state education, I feel like I wasn't diagnosed, because if I was diagnosed, the funding would be off, because then they would have to get somebody in to potentially help me. Yeah. And so I think in terms of funding, a lot of kids don't get diagnosed in the state system because it then means the school has to spend more money. I think in the private education, the difference in that is they have no legal obligation to understand, show understanding or support you. And so because of that, you know, my mum couldn't walk in and go, well, I've got this person from the council, I've got this person here and there, you know, this Senko needs to be doing this and this and this. And like, there wasn't that kind of legal obligation. So both of them were bad in different ways. I think if I had been diagnosed in school, then the support definitely would have been better in primary school. Yeah. And the support would have been better. So, yeah.
Did you find that when you went to boarding school, their approach was probably, well, you and your parents chose for you to come here. It's like tough luck, really. You can't, it's your own problem if you've got issues.
Well, my parents sent me there thinking it would be easier. It was a school where there were 50 people in a year and the school was absolutely massive. So, you know, there were at maximum like 20 people in the class, at absolute maximum. I mean, I don't even think that ever happened, apart from like PE we'd be split in two. But like for everything else, it would be kind of small classes. You know, I think the whole motto around my school was like, everyone can be an individual, which was the absolute, total opposite of what really happened, what it was like. But I think it looked great. I think like, you know, I think if somebody visited that school, they would think it looked great. It had like, we had an adventure playground and we played sports every day and this massive campus where we could walk through fields and we had chapel every morning in this beautiful chapel, and you know, girls could do horse riding. And I think the opportunities in terms of that were really amazing. But in terms of nurture, there was none. there was absolutely no nurturing. And I do think that particularly in a school where like you're there for so long, or it's a boarding school, there needs to be a kind of crossover of like the people who are the adults are in a way some sort of parental figure, especially in like the house mistresses and stuff like that, because you're seeing them considerably more than you're seeing your own parents. And I think that there was no nurturing at all. And I think in different ways that affected every single girl that went there, including, you know, not just me. It really affected me because of my disabilities and my ADHD, but I think it really affected a lot of girls' mental health, and yeah, not good.
Did you find social interaction as a youngster, and primarily like going into teenage years, a struggle, or were you okay like with interaction?
Well, I have quite a lot of anxiety, so I think that's probably the biggest struggle I find in social interaction. I think my biggest struggle is that I come across really extroverted, and I'm so introverted that it's actually quite insane. And so I think I, again, misunderstood. I think I can come across as like, not rude, but I'll come to a party or to see my friends, and then I'll get overwhelmed and leave 15 minutes later. And I think that comes across as like someone who's just like, I don't want to be here. I'm gonna leave. Where really it's just like, I just need to be in my bedroom because I feel like I'm too sensitive to other people's kind of energy, and I have sensory processing problems, so kind of loud noises and big crowds I can get quite overwhelmed by. But I think it's weird because the way I present is like super confident, and even, you know, social situations I come across quite confidently, which is a blessing, I think. But it makes it more difficult to explain to people that I am struggling, because it's hard to believe that because I don't come across like I'm struggling. I even have it at work at times, like with directors. I remember a director two years ago said to me that he thinks that I'm the type of person who's never doubted myself. And I thought that was just the funniest thing somebody could say to me, because I think I spend so much of my brain power every single day doubting everything I do, and everything I say, and everything. It's nice to know that that's not how I come across, because, you know, it is definitely, I can appreciate that it is even harder feeling bad and knowing that you're coming across badly is a big struggle, and then feeling powerless to change that is awful. But I feel like I'm grateful that that's how I come across, but it does make it more difficult to try and explain what's going on inside my head.
So when did dyspraxia start really impacting your life, and in what way does dyspraxia impact
you? Oh my gosh, so like always. Always. I used to walk backwards when I was a child, and I don't know, now I'm obviously trying to like pathologize that, and I don't explain it, and I was a child, so I don't know why I did it, but I feel like it could have been to do with the fact that walking forward felt just as confusing as walking backwards, and so why not backwards? And I used to, so in school I could read, I had an amazing reading age, but I wrote from the right side to the left side of the paper with all of my letters backwards.
Right.
But I could read the right way, but I wrote, I think because I was left-handed, so I wrote from the right side to the left side, and all the letters were backwards, and I wrote so, so slowly, like beyond slowly, to the point that writing a word could take me 10 minutes, and it would be so, so painful. And I think I really struggled with that, particularly at the big, like particularly in primary school, because it was so slow, and my brain is so fast and like a million miles an hour, and just struggling to even keep on with ideas whilst just trying to write one word. was really difficult. And then when I did manage to do it, giving it to a teacher and then being like, oh, you've written it all backwards again, and feeling like, oh my gosh, this took me days and I've done it completely wrong. And I think that definitely gave me the impression that I was stupid. I think I felt I really believed that I was stupid for so long. I think I would say it all the time, I'm so stupid. I just thought I was really dumb, which is funny now because I think I'm very intelligent. No, I don't think I'm, but you know, I know that I'm not dumb, and I know that I wasn't unintelligent, and I know that I just learn differently and I just do things differently. And for what I can't do in fast writing, I can do in fast imagination and creativity. And, you know, I think that's not talked about enough. You know, we kind of put a value on certain expressions of intelligence more than others. And it's so frustrating, you know, that if somebody can't read Shakespeare, but is able to, you know, write like the most beautiful lyrics, or is able to appreciate art. Appreciating art is a type of intelligence. Like everything that human beings are capable of, that the human condition is capable of, is a form of, you can be intelligent in that. And so it's so crazy to me that academics are kind of seen as the only, or the best, or the most valued form of intelligence. But yeah, I struggled from day dot. I think I struggled with walking. I think I struggled. I couldn't ride a bike. I couldn't figure out how to swim. And then I had like a sensory thing where I didn't want water to go on my face, which made it even harder to figure out how to swim. Yeah, it was an interesting one.
A lot of parallels with a lot of other dyspraxics there. I can hear a lot of myself in what you're saying, and a lot of what I've heard from other people as well. But I've asked this question of my other guests so far in this podcast. And what was your childbirth like? Was it straightforward, or do your parents have a recollection of it being a traumatic event?
My childbirth?
Yeah, your childbirth.
Oh, no, it was really difficult. I was pulled out. I mean, it was difficult for my mum. And I think for me, my mum thinks like, obviously, that that affects you in your life. So I was 2 weeks late, and my mum she has Crohn's disease, and they just knew that if I came out any later, that she was at a high risk of dying. And so I was forcibly induced, and then like pulled out with forceps, and like, I don't know, but I know I came out with a cone head because of how they'd like had to pull me out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, not ideal.
No. A lot of dyspraxics say they, or people with like on the umbrella of hidden disability, say that their childbirth may have had an impact on their disabilities, may have caused disabilities.
Wow.
My own personal theory is not scientific. I had a traumatic childbirth. I had the umbilical cord strangled around my neck, so I lost oxygen for a little while. And my sister's autistic. She had a childbirth, but my brother, who had a normal childbirth, is perfectly fine.
And it's wow.
In my head, I think that could be a factor, but I wouldn't say that's 100% accurate. But I start to think
that's so interesting, though.
Like that kind of impact on your head, like lack of oxygen or
yes.
on the skull, the brain is barely formed. I kind of think, could that be a reason? Obviously, there's other things at play, like genetics, perhaps, or so I just find it too surreal not to be the case in some cases, though.
Yeah. Wow. I never even thought of that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, there's a lot of theories that I've heard from other people, and like you'll hear them in the podcast as they get released. But everyone has their own sort of persuasion on how they came about getting dyspraxia.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So you touched on your mum having Crohn's, but obviously your siblings all have hidden disabilities as well.
Yes.
How do you all cope with that? And is it like, do you all have like a mutual understanding of each other, and do you all tolerate?
Yeah. It's mad in our house. It's absolutely bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers, and it's brilliant and wonderful and sometimes incredibly difficult. I think our house is definitely a sanctuary in terms of, like, I think anyone who comes here who is in any way non-neurotypical or neurodiverse or if anyone who's neurodiverse in any capacity, I think, feels very at home in our house, which is really lovely. So yeah, it's interesting. It's everyone has their quirks, like, big time. And I think that it does help that we're all a family of creatives, because there's already a bit of, like, bonkers energy anyway, just, like, in the house. And so I think because of that, it's not too difficult in terms of understanding people's stuff. My mum has autism in her family. I'm almost certain that my dad has ADHD. And so I think that there was definitely a kind of understanding of, like, what, you know, different people look like and what different people behave like, and that it's okay if there's somebody in the family that can only use a certain plate, and, like, that's just fine. Like, it's not even a, okay, cool, you just, that's the plate that you use, that's the cutlery you use. And it's okay if, like, sometimes people have to change all the alarms on their phone because if it's, like, a certain sound, somebody's going to be overwhelmed. Like, that's, it's not even, that stuff is not a big deal because it's so normalized. I think the weird thing is kind of going out into the outside world and realizing that for other people that is seems so wild and so crazy. I think there are so many more crazy things in the world that, like, like, little things like that just seem so so minor to me. And I think it's brilliant. Like, why would we assume that everybody is the same? I would feel really, really weird, I think, if I was growing up in an environment where every single person was exactly the same, and every person just, yeah, that's so weird to me.
That was weird, wasn't it? You was involved in the launch and gave a speech at the All Party Parliamentary Group, otherwise known as the APPG event for ADHD. How did that come about, and what are your hopes for that group going forward?
So I was contacted, I think, potentially through my mum about that, and they asked if I wanted to speak, and I was absolutely over the moon too. I hadn't really publicly spoken about my ADHD before then, particularly, just because there hadn't been the opportunity to in the way that I wanted to. And so it was such a joy to be able to speak at that event. And my hope for that, oh my goodness, I have so many hopes for that. I think it's, in terms of, like, I just think it starts from the very beginning. It starts from how we raise, sorry, there's a really loud plane, can you hear that? It starts from how we raise children, how we do schools, what we spoke about earlier in terms of the narrative that you're fed as a child if you present differently, and, like, that usually having something to do with the fact that you're either disobedient or naughty or disruptive. I don't think people realize the extent that that can affect somebody. You know, I think that even if you look at the prison population and how many people in prison have ADHD and hidden disabilities, there's a lot. It's a lot. And I do think that that definitely has something to do with the very beginning, how people are raised, how people are, you know, telling somebody that they're badly behaved because of something that they can't control is dangerous. It's really, really awful. And I think that there needs to be more conversation around that. There needs to be more conversation around also, like, understanding what ADHD looks like past the naughty 5-year-old child, or, you know, the 5-year-old who can't sit still. Like, past that, and usually a boy, the 5-year-old boy who can't sit still, past that image of what that's all really people know of ADHD. How does it present in the way that we communicate with people, and how does it present in women, and how does it present in adults, and how does it present in your teenage years, and all of that stuff. And I think that if there's more understanding around that, then, oh my gosh, everything. I think that mental health would be so much better. I think that there would be less people with disabilities in prison. I think that it would change. It would change so much. And I think that a big problem is that, like, parents are made to feel like they are failing as a parent if their child is presenting as ADHD, because instead of recognizing that that person's struggling because of a disability, it's kind of put down to bad parenting. And so, like, what that either does is the parents get really angry at the child and the child feels loads of shame, or the parents get stricter and then the child feels even more like, oh my gosh, I can't get it right at school and at home, or the parents just feel absolute despair and the child feels like they've disappointed people. I think it's just the conversation and the language around it needs to be there and more and more and more and more. And I think my also, again, like, the biggest thing that I want to be doing for people who aren't children, and also children, but, you know, really for people who are struggling at, you know, my age and teenage and able to have these conversations, is give people the language to be able to advocate for themselves. Because I think that having the language to advocate for yourself is, for me, it was the biggest game changer out there. Because people think that they understand. You know, I remember saying to a director, just so you know, I have ADHD. And he said, well, I don't think you have OCD. And I said, well, no, I said, I have ADHD. And he didn't really understand what I was even saying. He said, well, no, you don't. And I said, do you know what it is? And he didn't know what it was, but he felt entitled enough to tell me that I didn't have it. And so I think that, like, in that moment, I felt incredibly shaken and just kind of walked away. But now, you know, I think if I'd have had the language or the statistics, or if you have, like, these phrases or sentences in order to advocate for yourselves, very, very quickly people realize that what they think they know, they actually don't know. And therefore there's a place that they can learn. So I think that that is, for me, the most important thing.
Nice. And you've shown a great passion as well for poetry in most of your interviews.
Yes.
Is that because you like to reflect backwards, back in the past, and write about your experiences? And also, does your dyspraxia cause any issues with handwriting?
My dyspraxia now causes issues with writing, in terms of I push too hard on the paper, so I really easily get, I'm not very good with, like, knowing what pressure to do.
Yeah.
And so I get, like, hand ache and stuff. But my handwriting now, I think with certain things, in terms of coordination, I got so obsessive about it being perfect that now my handwriting is almost, like, nicer than someone without dyspraxia, because I spent so long kind of perfecting it. But yeah, I press too hard. And in terms of the poetry I write poetry because it's the way that I figured out how to communicate to myself. I think that I can feel so overwhelmed by other people's energy and what other people are thinking and trying to, whatever, just processing the world around me, that I really struggle to locate myself and my own feelings and still my brain enough to kind of connect with myself. And I went through a breakup a few years ago, and I felt suddenly like, oh my gosh, I'm completely alone. And I booked a flight to Rome, a one-way ticket to Rome. And I just, the day I got there, I bought a notebook and I started writing poetry. And I had written in the past, but it hadn't been a thing that I did. And I stayed for you know, a month and a half, 2 months in different places in Europe. And I wrote, oh my gosh, I wrote like 10 to 20 poems every day, over, you know, hundreds of poems. And I felt so connected to myself. It was like I was having a conversation with myself, and I had never felt connected to myself like that. And I realized, I think it definitely has to do with going away, but I realized that writing, yeah, it's the way that I process the world around me. Because sometimes in my head it feels so chaotic that writing it down and, yeah, playing with language, just it makes everything make sense.
And you started acting relatively young as well.
Yeah.
Did you start poetry relatively young, or was that just like later on in life?
So in school, I loved writing poetry. Like, I absolutely loved it. And I was like, I was the person in school who, like, if we wrote a poem, like, my poem would get, like, stuck up somewhere. Like, it was always like, I was like, oh, that's something I think I'm quite good at. But I just never really did it after that. It was never something I did for myself. And I think the more and more I got the narrative of feeling unintelligent, it just became something I didn't do for myself. And then I went to drama school. And in drama school, we looked at poetry a lot. And, you know, we at times had to write poems in the style, so we'd write a poem in the style of, you know, a metaphysical poem, or a poem using one word but like using it in loads of different ways and switching out the start of the word and the end of the word. And it was then that I began to write again. And I remember writing a poem about my brother, and I felt, not that the poem was amazing, but I felt moved by writing the poem, like I was processing something and connecting to myself and connecting to feelings and thoughts that I don't think I was able to directly locate in my life. So then that was when I kind of started writing more. So I was around 18.
Nice. And you've previously lent your voice to backing vocals for the likes of Jerry Halliwell and stuff like that. And obviously your parents are renowned vocal coaches and singers in their own right. What drove you more into acting than music?
I think when I was younger, I had a terrible fear of people telling me, oh yeah, you've done that because your parents, haven't you? And people already said that with acting when I was younger. And it used to really get to me. I've learnt that it's a silly thing to let bother me now, but I learnt it a lot later in life. So it used to really get to me. And so I think I kind of tried to put a bit of a block in between me and the association with doing something because of my parents. And so I didn't do music. And it was only 2017 that I started recording again. I started recording with my friends, and it really was like such an amazing experience, because I realized that I love writing. I mean, I played guitar every day, but I was never doing it as a thing that I wanted to release. And I just realized I love music so much, equally to in the way that I love acting. So that is something I am pursuing now. And I'm in the process of recording some songs that I've written, and hopefully we'll be releasing them in the near future, not so distant future.
Oh, brilliant. I look forward to that. And did your social anxiety ever cause you any issues in your current profession in acting, along with, like, say, you touched on directors earlier, not understanding ADHD, etc. Do you find also coordination's a problem on set, where you get instructions to be left, right, etc.?
On set, yes. I think I struggle if I feel like someone doesn't like me.
Yeah.
Then I can get quite in my head and like really concerned about it and anxious about it. And I think that it really annoys me that I have that quality, because it can affect me at any point. And I could be at work, and there's often happens at work, and it's nothing to do, you know, the person could absolutely think I'm the best person they've ever met, but in my head, if I get this feeling, oh my gosh, they don't like me, or they're annoyed at me, or anything negative, I can really just begin to kind of go into a downward spiral about it. And so, yeah, it does affect me in that way. And I have to figure out like tactics for that not to happen. It also affects me in terms of, I just have general anxiety. So if I'm tired, for example, I feel a lot more anxious. And so waking up early before I leave the house, I have to do a lot of kind of things in order to lower my cortisol levels. So I have to like stretch, and I'll put on music and like do kind of breathing. Otherwise I can feel like a real panic that isn't actually related to anything or the fact I'm about to work or anything like that. It's just kind of it's like a chemical reaction in my brain. And then also, yeah, it affects my social skills in terms of onset, and it did at drama school as well. And I think that there have definitely been times where, again, because I present as really confident, and then I might not socialize as much, I might not go out with the cast and crew as much as other people, or you know, I often need to just go back to my apartment and unwind by myself. And I think that I do worry that sometimes that comes across negatively, and it has in the past been informed to me that that has come across negatively. So it is a difficulty, because a part of me is like, well, I really should try to be social. And then the other half of me is like, well, I am at work and I do have to put my needs first, and going out isn't, you know, it's not work, it's not a big priority, it's just a social thing. And so it is hard to weigh out those things and figure out what the best thing to do is.
Sure. And do you find that you consciously think you have to be more sociable than you need to be in order to maintain these relationships with like casting directors or acting friends or whoever, just to maintain your profile?
Well, no, in the outside world, yeah. I don't have any friends who are actors.
Okay.
Not because I dislike actors, just because that's just my friendship group is not that really.
Yeah.
So in the outside world, I don't ever really feel the pressure to network, because I've accepted that that's something I hate. I dislike networking, so I'm not going to try to do it. So I don't think I feel more pressure than is necessary. I think I don't feel pressure initially. So, you know, if I'm at work, I won't go for drinks in the evening. And then after, I realize that the impression that I'm giving off is that I don't like people or I don't want to hang out with people, which is not how I'm feeling. It's just that I'm just not that social. I'm an introvert, but I come across like an extrovert. And so I have to then I do get worried that I'm coming across as rude, or I feel a pressure to change this view that's been kind of made of me being someone who doesn't want to hang out with people, you know.
Yeah. And do you find that your ADHD and dyspraxia causes problems in terms of learning scripts or remembering certain dialogue that you learn on the day, etc.?
Honestly, I think I have like a semi-photographic memory in terms of learning scripts.
Yeah.
So that is the biggest blessing, because I think if I didn't have that skill, that I would be really the other end of things. So no, in terms of learning lines, I don't struggle with that. But I do sometimes, like, it is difficult coming to set and figuring out what scene we're doing. And I think sometimes I can come across like a bit chaotic, like I'll come with my bag and I'll have to, like in school, I'll have to figure out where the thing is that has the lines on, and then I'll have to like get my pen out to write notes, and I'll have, you know, and so I think the way that other people are is they come and they're like ready with the script, and sometimes I'm just a bit slower at that stuff, and so yeah, that can be difficult.
And you've got on to work on massive shows such as EastEnders, Fleabag, Sex Education and Save Me. Could you have dreamed of that as a young girl who had problems with, say, concentration, fidgeting and getting in trouble for not listening? you've certainly not allowed that to hold you back. So do you find working on these big shows daunting, or do you embrace the what most people would consider stressful?
I actually embrace it, I think. I had such a difficult time in school, such a difficult time, where I was constantly told I would not succeed at anything in life. And then I went to drama school and I had an even worse time where I was, you know, treated awfully by the teachers and the pupils and bullied and again told that, you know, if I couldn't survive this, that I wouldn't make anything of myself in the industry. And so I think that every single time I'm on a set and people are being nice to me and I feel happy and I, you know, I feel so lucky, and I also feel like all of that bad stuff, I'm glad that it happened, because I feel it gives me like such immense gratitude for the life that I have now. And that doesn't mean that the life I have now is without problems, because it's not. But one, I'm an adult now, so I'm able to say I'm struggling with this, or I'm able to say to myself, you're struggling with this and let's figure out how to fix this in the way that I wasn't when I was younger. And two, I'm not surrounded so much by people who are actively trying to tear me down in the way that I think I was a lot of my education.
Okay, and how did you cope then with the complexities of playing a victim of sexual trafficking in Lenny James's Save Me Too on Sky Atlantic? I imagine that was a terrifying responsibility to get that part right, because of the nature of the dialogue and the characters.
Yeah, it was, Grace was incredibly difficult to play. Do you know what? Grace was incredibly difficult to figure out how to play. Once, and to play actually. It was difficult to go into that world. I think that was the hard part. It was doing a service, but I think the hardest part was feeling safe enough to go deep into that psyche. Because once I was in it, I struggled to get out of it until the job was done. And I haven't experienced that actually on any other job. Usually I'm the queen of, you know, we finish work and my work is done and I go home and I am Olive and I'm living my life. And I really struggled to find that at all with Grace. She was all consuming. And I think that I was so immersed in her that it became actually harder to let go of her when I finished than it was in finding her when I started. So yeah, but I did, of course, I felt a responsibility. I think for me, my favorite thing about acting, and if I was to say like, the skill that I feel like I can bring to the table in terms of acting is that I have a fascination with the mind and the psyche and how different things in life lead you to the point that you're in. And so I think that I was given the biggest gift with Grace, because there was so much information there and also so much space to create. And so I felt a responsibility to her trauma to show an accurate portrayal of what trauma looks like and what childhood trauma, how that manifests as an adult, and what, not just, you know, in the court scene where she's speaking about her horrific thing, which of course is, that's a lot of responsibility, but just how she interacts with the world that she hasn't really been a part of in the way that most people have for the past, you know, 4 years. So that was where that's really where my focus is in any role, actually, is really trying to understand how everything that's happened in their lives has led them to this point and what that looks like, what, you know, growing up and the fact that she was molested by her stepfather, how does that manifest in the person she is today? How does that affect the every single decision that she makes from that point on, because she's not a healed person. Grace, the character, is not, she's not a healed person. So she's like a completely, she's an open, you know, wound in terms of her trauma. So it was the biggest gift, honestly. Playing Grace was the biggest gift that Lenny could have possibly given me. I couldn't be more grateful and more honoured to be able to play that character.
I really enjoyed watching it. I thought it was well written, well acted, and well, like, directed. Just,
yes.
I don't often sit down and tune into a show when it comes out live anymore. But
that's, yeah,
one of the few shows that I did, like, oh, I want to sit down with my partner and watch that. Like, don't,
yeah,
any spoilers, just want to watch it. Or even if it came out in one go. I think if it was live, or we watched it as a box set. But, like, it's just one of those things that grips you. You're compelled to watch it to find out,
yeah,
what happens. It's,
I had that too. Oh, my gosh. I rewatched series one with a friend of mine just before season two came out, because they hadn't seen it. So I was even rewatching it like, oh my gosh, this is insane. And I was so gripped, even though I knew what was going to happen. And the same with series two. I was so, you know, gripped by all of, there's so many stories going on at the same time. It's just the most beautiful portrayal of life and the rawness of life in London.
Nice. And I know it's a bit hard question at the moment, but you've touched on your plans for music in the future. What else have you got lined up, or would you like to do in the future?
So at some point next year, I have a series called Halo coming out, which is based on Halo, the video game. It's being produced by Amblin for Showtime. And I was filming that up until lockdown. And then we're going to be back at it again, and then it will come out, which I'm so excited about. I've never done, you know, to go from something like Save Me, which is a gritty drama based in London, to you know, space and robots and aliens and all of that is incredibly mad and exciting. So yeah, just doing that.
Nice. I look forward to that. Lovely. What help didn't you get as a youngster with ADHD and dyspraxia that you wish you could have had looking back? Is there anything in particular that you would have liked to have had put in place?
I would have loved to have had somebody to recognise where I was trying. I think I really thrive on encouragement. And if I feel believed in and encouraged by somebody, all I want to do is to make them believe in me and encourage me more. Similarly, when I feel discouraged, all I am inclined to do is to do things that affirm their view in me, because, you know, I think a part of me is a bit like, well, if you think I'm that bad, I'll show you how bad I can be, that kind of thing. So I think I would have loved to have been just seen and encouraged, and where I was trying recognized. I think it's about, I was going to say small wins, but I don't think they're small. I just think they're not the wins that people maybe look for. You know, if I wrote a story, but I wrote all of it backwards, you know, maybe the first thing to say would be, oh, to read the story and tell me what you think of the story. And then we can have a conversation about the fact that, you know, all of it's backwards. But first and foremost, I've just shown my creativity and my imagination, and I've managed to write something on a piece of paper, and that is the hardest thing in the world when my hand feels like it goes like -100 miles per hour. So yeah, I think that is, it's so simple, but I think it can make such a world of difference.
Nice. And what would you say is your hope for the future in regards to the awareness of hidden disabilities, where do you think we'll be in 10 years' time?
Well, I don't know where we will be, but I know I want to be in a place where hidden disabilities are less hidden, where people are speaking about them more, where people are trying to understand what I wish that I could say to somebody, you know, I have dyspraxia, and they have enough of a knowledge to go, oh yeah, I get what that means. And you know what? I wish that if not, they would have the ears to listen instead of spouting what they think they know or telling or trying to silence my voice. So I hope that there's just more of an understanding. And I also hope that there is more of an understanding that hidden disabilities just exist. I think that if we all just have that in our heads, then we're not going to take every single person we meet as a neurotypical person. And therefore, if they deviate from that, think that they're acting really odd or think that they're behaving in a negative way. I think growing up in this family is such a blessing, because every person I meet, my instant assumption is not that they're neurotypical ever. It's not that they're, it's just a person. And so anything of their behavior is helping me to understand them rather than helping me judge them. And so I think that if more people could have that kind of way of viewing people, or way of kind of having a blank slate before you meet somebody and allowing them to tell you who they are and show you who they are, and not putting a judgment on who they are based on your knowledge of how people are supposed to behave, but just, do you know Brené Brown? I think she's a doctor, but she has a load of TED Talks, and she also has, she did a podcast that I was listening to recently, and I think she speaks stuff about shame and vulnerability, and she's a genius, she's amazing. But one of the things she was speaking about is, what if we went into the world and assumed that everyone is trying their best? She was like, what if I told you that every single person is trying their best? And, you know, the person interviewing her said, well, do you think that everyone's trying their best? And she said, I don't know, but I know that I have a much better life if I think that way. And I think if we could all have that view, it would be so much better. Rather than going, that person's behaving oddly, they're trying to be insolent or rude, or they're trying to annoy me, or they don't care. Just go, oh, do you know what? They're trying their best. So let me try to understand why they're behaving like this in a way that I'm not framing it as a judgment or thinking that they're a negative, rather that I'm trying to understand how their brain works and the positives, you know?
Sure, sure. Where can we find you on social media, Olive?
So my Instagram is Olive is Gray, G-R-A-Y. And my Twitter is Olive is Gray, but with two Y's at the end.
Nice.
Olive is Gray, yeah. Or just search up Olive Gray and I'm there.
Perfect, perfect. I would like to personally thank you for joining us today, Olive.
Thank you so much.
That's okay. Your courage to lead the way for dyspraxia and ADHD will mean so much for us all. We wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you.